transportation for our first meeting of the month of May. We are now doing house bills, and we'll see what we can do with this and see if we can find any errors in the housework as we take them on in the Senate today. We'll do this by opening up public hearing on House Bill 2792. Janet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2792 amends ORS 757-069 and provides that a water utility mail notice of delinquency to property owners only has to be sent if the utility asserts that the property owners are responsible for the bill. There's a 55-0 House vote, and what you have at your place is the House staff measure summary.
Okay, we've got a trio has signed up on this bill. Jason, Mark, and Amanda. Okay. And we get a little nervous when we have bills dealing with water this session, but welcome.
Chair Metzger and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today to tell you about House Bill 2792. For the record, my name is Jason Huser, Legislative Affairs Manager for the Eugene Water and Electric Board, and I'm joined here by my colleague Mark Freeman. We're here today advocating passage of House Bill 2792, a what-you-see-is-what-you-get technical fix to Senate Bill 563 that was passed in the 2005 session. SB 563 amended ORS 757-069 to require that water utilities mail notice of a water bill delinquent 120 days to the real property owners of a residence in question. This 2005 change was attempting to address an individual constituent issue where a utility's billing policy had meant a tenant's unpaid bill had impeded the ability of a new tenant and the property owner to have water service at the residence. SB 563 reasoned that a property owner should be noticed at a certain point in that type of scenario. We understand and appreciate the sentiment of what prompted SB 563. At EWEB, we would simply not hold a property owner or anyone other than the specific water customer liable for an unpaid bill. Neither the property owner nor a future tenant, provided that the new tenant had no relationship to this previous tenant with an unpaid bill, would be held liable for a bill, nor would we withhold any new service to that residence. Properly, EWEB would refer an unpaid bill to a collection agency, which would also hold only the customer for that unpaid bill liable to pay it. So under House Bill 2792, notice property owners would only be required if a utility asserts the property owner is responsible for an unpaid bill. This legislation would remedy the following problems that arise when ORS 757-069 is applied. Since EWEB does not discuss an occupant's tenant's delinquent bill with an owner unless the occupant or tenant has authorized the owner to receive such information, a notice of delinquency would be of no real value to an owner. Secondly, a notice of delinquency could refer to one or more former occupants or tenants and would not specify the identity of the occupant and tenant nor the amount owing. An owner who received such notice and contacted EWEB could not be given any personal information regarding the identity of the debtor, the amount owed, the dates of service, etc., without prior occupant authorization. And that just results in a potentially confusing communication between EWEB and these property owners. And there's an attachment that kind of describes a hypothetical conversation that could occur, kind of showing the confusion that could arise on the telephone. And thirdly, additional staff time and resources would be required to locate real property owners without any real good public purpose being served. Simply put, the net effect of House Bill 2792 is that notice will still be required to property owners any time a utility would be holding them responsible, but it won't be required if the utility is not holding them responsible. I think it makes a lot of sense, and there was a unanimous vote in the House. We hope you folks will see this bill as the same type of proper remedy and a technical fix. And with that, I'll pause and see if there's any questions.
Okay, well, let's see if anybody else has any other comments they want to add, and then we'll see if there's questions.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Amanda Rich, and I'm here today representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. And I would concur with everything that my colleague has just put on the record here. Frankly, we do we agree with the with what this bill was trying to accomplish last session, or the bill that Jason mentioned. But I think it was in the implementation of the bill that we discovered the problems. We discovered that different water utilities use different billing systems and hold different people responsible for delinquencies. And so we concur. My largest water district, Tualatin Valley Water District, has been trying very hard to comply with this, has taken a lot of resources and time, and they would never hold a property owner responsible. And so we support this fix and hope that you'll give favorable consideration to the bill.
Okay. I'm just here backing him up.
Okay. So, and I appreciate, Jason, you visiting with me about this earlier. And I think the gist of the issue is that because of the new law, you have to go find out who the owner is. You're not going to charge him anyway, but you got to send him a notice, and it's just kind of a redundancy without a solution that doesn't solve anything. And so I think, as you mentioned, as long as the water utility isn't holding anybody responsible, you shouldn't have to go through the hoops of telling people that, by the way, we're not holding you responsible. Any questions?
Just comment. I think it's interesting. I have rentals, and it's very frustrating. Now the electric company have no problem, and water at this point I don't have any problem. But with the sanitation, I do, because if my tenants won't pay for the I've just taken over paying for the garbage, because they require, if my tenants don't pay for the garbage pickup, then I am ultimately responsible. So maybe we need another law to take
care
of. Let's
look at a related clause to garbage collection. And then we know a couple people could come into the committee.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I was unfortunate the relating clause in this bill is so narrow, because I would throw all the utilities in this bill.
Hmm. Well, thank you. And I appreciate the Eugene Water Electric Board, too, that recognizing that there is a customer, and that the customer is the one who's responsible, not anybody else, and I do appreciate that. If there's nothing else and no one else yearning to discuss this bill, I'll close the public hearing on 2792 and open a work session. Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2792 to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered, and let's see. Let's give this to Senator Walker. I mean, I just have this, you know, it's Eugene. I just have a funny feeling that she would be a perfect one to carry that
Senator
bill.
Excused.
Oh, yes, and we'll show Senator George is excused on all our votes today. Are you on the next bill, too? Oh, okay. Then you're dismissed. Open up public hearing on House Bill 2107. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2107 requires construction contractors to notify the Construction Contractors Board of unpaid judgments or arbitration awards against the contractor. And this is a bill that was brought at the request of the Construction Contractors Board. There is no fiscal and no revenue impact statement, and the House vote is at your place today.
Mr. Smith, Mr. Kafori, you want to come forward? Signed up on the bill?
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, I'm Craig Smith with the Construction Contractors Board, and we bring before you today House Bill 2107A, which is a CCB bill filed before session. What it would do is it would require construction contractors to tell us about judgments if they haven't been paid, that have been ordered by the court, and it has to do with construction work. In the past, of course, as you well know, we process disputes against contractors, and in the middle of this handout, you'll see some of the numbers about the number of complaints that we process. About 1,300 last year resulted in about $3 million of orders, but sadly, about $1,000,008 wasn't paid. That's just the CCB stuff, and I don't want to make it sound like a lot of contractors are out of compliance, but there are some orders that are done by the court system. We don't know when that occurs, and we'd like licensees to have an obligation to tell us if they have an order against them and it's not paid. If they do that, if you choose to make this law, we'll accept those judgments. We'll probably put that information on the website, And if the judgment isn't paid, we'll likely suspend the contractor's license.
Mr. Kafouri.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafouri. I'm here representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. We're generally supportive of the support of the bill. There is a problem, and we've heard it through testimony of the Construction Claims Task Force last time, and we've heard it through many sessions. People come in and say, I checked out this person's CCB records, and he looked okay on the website. Then I had him come, and he couldn't finish my house in the middle of the work because he had this judgment, and he couldn't get any more materials or whatever. And so they left me stranded in the middle of a project. Why couldn't I have gotten that information from CCB? And the answer is because CCB has no authority to gather that information in the first place. So doesn't happen very often. If you look at this number of complaints filed, 1,300 complaints. There are something like 45,000 licensed folks out there, and each one of them are doing maybe, I don't know, 5 projects a year, 10 projects a year as an average. So there's hundreds of thousands of projects going on out there, and only 1,300 claims filed. So basically, people are doing a good job. But if somebody does a bad job and leaves you in the middle of a big construction thing, and you've got to pay a lot of money to get out of it, it's very important to you. This is anecdotally important if it's not statistically important. And those folks, of course, come to the legislature, and so that's the reason we have this. But I do have one concern, and that is, I talked to Mr. Smith about this earlier, how they would use the information. Because suppose a scenario, not the bad guy, but suppose the good guy, has done some work and got a $10,000 judgment in court against him. If he then has to report that $10,000 judgment to Craig Smith, and then they put on the website, then he doesn't get any more work, how's he going to pay the $10,000 back? So I talked to Craig, how is the CCB going to administratively separate the good guys from the bad guys? The people who come to him and say, look, I got a $100,000 claim, I can't pay it all, I'm paying it off at $5,000 a month, don't put me on your list. And the response I got from Craig was that they would treat these things, each case individually, based on their individual merits, administratively. And so I asked if he would say that on the record. That would make my folks feel a whole lot better.
So, Chair Metzger and members of the committee, Craig Smith again. What gets on the website, I think, is one issue. Whether or not we suspend the contractor's license would be another. At this point, we would plan on putting all pertinent information on the website. I think the public really wants that. They want to know if a contractor has debts that are paid or unpaid. And so the information we put on the website is going to be 100% of what we receive. But the suspension, if there appears to be a good faith effort on the part of a licensee to pay a debt, for heaven's sakes, I don't think we want to take that license away. And so my promise to you and to the industry is that should you make this law, we would take a look at each case, and if there appears to be payments being made, we would not take the license away.
Okay. Questions?
Yeah.
Sir, Mars Harris.
That doesn't solve your problem, though.
Senator Metzger, Senator Anderson, Moses Anderson, that gets us most of the way there. It still is a concern. People using the website, they're using it a lot, and people are looking at who they're going to hire, and if they see something on there that says this person has got a judgment for breach of contract or negligent or improper work, and it's not paid within 30 days, as the bill calls for, then they're going to get it on the website, and that's not a happy situation for us.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I don't see the home builders in the room. Are they supportive, opposed, neutral?
Chair Metzger and Senator Starr, I can tell you that I've shared this material with the home builders, and they have not told me that they have a problem with that. But on the other side of the coin, I don't see them here supporting the bill either.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, please.
Is it possible that we could further amend this bill that would make it clear that if a contractor is making payment on an unpaid judgment, that that contractor would not be... I'm concerned about we're basically putting somebody out of business the minute they get something on the website. They're not going to be able to get more work because folks do check the website. And then, you know, we got this outstanding judgment out there. He has no means of making a living to to pay it off. I don't think that's just, and I don't think that's where we want to head. So I don't want to give the department that much discretion, quite honestly. I'd rather have it in black and white.
Yeah, I think another thing, Craig, I would be a little concerned about, too, is I support what you're trying to do. I mean, because I think consumer awareness and, you know, bad actors, et cetera.
Right.
But we don't want to get people in the loophole. I mean, you can get a judgment, and it's not necessarily because you did that you were trying to deceive anything. It just, things may not work well, and there was a dispute, and you found that you need to be liable for it, and a good contractor will step up at the plate and, make having made their case, you know, pay the judgment and move on. One thing I think would be really concerned is that, especially with the web, is that I'd like to have some type of thing where if you have someone who has to pay some type of judgment and has fulfilled those and fulfills those obligations, some assurance that they're not going to just stay on the web page, you know, with a you know, something that has been, you know, satisfied, you know, rather than a, say, a litany list of, you know, someone whose life, assuming they're doing the right thing and moving forward, so that they're not necessarily blacklisted for doing the right thing. And I'd also would be concerned, as Senator Starr would be, that that we don't act in such a manner, that fine line between making sure that the statute is very clear about that. Because I think when people are doing the wrong thing, and especially when they start getting a litany of some of this stuff, people need to know that, and then you need to take action to make sure that they're not doing that. But people can get judgments, you know, contractors who are very, very good contractors and whatever just lose an argument and tend to do everything correctly. And, you know, I wouldn't want them all of a sudden to be, before they have a chance to really make that situation done. I'd like to chat with a little bit about that. I think I'll talk with Senator Starr and you and see if we can just clarify this a little bit more and just if that's okay with you. We have a little time to do that. I think we want to get where you're at. Just don't want to have any unintended consequences like the e-web bill we just heard, creating more work for people that we didn't really have to do.
Can I ask someone if this will follow up? You mentioned, or you listed the 1,346 complaints filed. That doesn't say anything. Out of those 1,346 complaints, not all 1,346 complaints created a judgment against a contractor. Can you give me the numbers that actually, of the 1,300 and so, that actually consummated or came to an end point where there was a judgment against a contractor?
Chair Metzger and Senator Starr, it's a very good question. I meant to have that answered for you, too. And I don't have that in my paperwork. I'll give you the precise numbers. Your question is a good one, and that is that it points out the fact that well under the 1,300 result in these complaints. And as a matter of fact, it was under 200 that, closer to 100 that resulted in the unpaid. So it was a very small percentage. And we think it's a very small percentage of contractors outside of our view, who don't pay court judgments. And so it is a small percentage. The problem we've had, frankly, is that those few have been spoiling it for all of the good guys. And when the consumers come to our webpage and can't get accurate information, they can't rely upon the government then. And so we thought that it made some sense to say, okay, contractors, if you don't pay it, you can have a good faith dispute. That happens. We've all been in business. We've been there. But if you don't pay it within 30 days, and you ought to be telling your licensing agency and working out a payment plan, or otherwise maybe look for another line of work. So we're happy to table this and come back and talk to you another time.
Yeah, we'll work on something just to make that a little clearer. Okay, thank you very much. We'll bring the bill back, Craig.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2107. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2309. Janet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2309 is at the request of the Judiciary Committee for the Methamphetamine Task Force, and it would require creation of a contractor bond requirement alternative by the Construction Contractors Board for nonprofit organizations that are rehabilitating illegal drug manufacturing sites. Mr. Chair, it came out of the House unanimously, both in committee and on the House floor. Thank you.
Okay, I have Anna Peterson, Rob Blavette, and Mitch Teedle. Welcome.
Thank you.
Want me to start? Good afternoon, Senator Metzger and members of the committee. My name is Mitch Teal, and I reside here in Salem. I'm the 2006 president of Salem Association of Realtors, and got involved in this methamphetamine project, which was the rehabilitation of a residential home. In short, we took a house that was a blight in the neighborhood and rehabbed it from the ground up, hauling away after the contamination contractor was done. I think we hauled away 11,000 pounds of additional garbage and ended up painting the house and stripping it down and re-landscaping and sprinklers and all new inside and out, and then sold it in an effort to both rehab the community and invest in what it is that we do, which is make our livings through the sale of real estate, and a good community project, and then also to try to show leadership and show people that this can be done, that these don't have to remain as blights in our communities. And in that process, we found that there were a number of snags, one of which we're here meeting about today, and that is the fact that to get the process rolling, we had to put our executive officer at risk in that we needed to have a bond for this process, and in doing so, it requires, under previous statute or existing statute, that there be a person, a human being, signed off on that. And that, we thought, was wholly unfair to her and her husband. And although they were willing to do it and it came off without a snag, it put them at risk. By handling this situation before you, what it allows is one less hurdle for nonprofits who would like to go out there and follow our lead and take on a project of this magnitude. At the end of the day, it turned out to be, it was a beautiful little neighborhood, tree-lined street in Kaiser. We returned the house to be, I think, a role model in the neighborhood, although all of them were nice with the exception of this one. This one really stood out when we were done. We sold the property. We were able to bank some money in the organization, which is still where it was in a bank account, and they will be looking for yet another project to do the same type of thing and provide some housing opportunities and, again, to clean up a neighborhood in our community. So with your help, I hope you will consider this carefully and make that process a little easier for those who will follow.
Thank you, Mr. Teal.
Thank you.
Chair Metzger and members of the committee, I'm Anna Peterson. I chair the Governor's Meth Task Force. I'm also the co-founder 4 years ago of No Meth Not in My Neighborhood, the Marion County area Task Force on Methamphetamine. We came together as business people and civic leaders, as volunteers, to fight methamphetamine in our community. We were overjoyed when the Salem Association of Realtors chose to rehab a meth lab site and a deteriorated blight house in the community, and we applaud what they did. I want to mention that none of the realtors profited in any way from the house, and what they did in that community was remarkable. I wish you could see the pictures of before and after. I wish you could talk to the neighbors and hear them expound what a difference it was to turn away the bad memories of that drug property and to rehabilitate it. So I'm here today to speak not only about this project, but to encourage you to pass House Bill 2309, because it will substantially allow us to encourage organizations across the state to take the model that this organization has presented and carry that into communities statewide.
Thank you. Mr. Bovette.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rob Bovette, subcommittee chair for the Governor's Meth Task Force and legal counsel for the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association. I'll keep it very brief. The good news is we got rid of meth labs in Oregon. We eliminated them. We didn't just reduce them. We haven't had a real meth lab incident in Oregon for over 6 months, so we've eliminated meth labs. The bad news is we still have a backlog of these uncleaned meth lab sites that are essentially small toxic waste sites. This bill is a good bill. would allow. It doesn't escape the bonding requirement. It provides for alternatives for sureties, so cash deposits, other bank notes, instead of just that little box created that they struggled with. So it's a good bill. As committee counsel mentioned, it passed unanimously both in the committee and in the House. With that, I'll just say ditto, do pass, and I'm happy to answer any questions about this or the process.
Thank you.
Questions?
Senator Stark. Yeah, in order to be a contractor, you got to be licensed, you got to have a bond. Your contractor's bond isn't good on a project like this?
Do you want to try to explain?
Sorry, I didn't catch the last part of the question.
Well, in order to be a contractor in Oregon, you have to be licensed, you got to have insurance, and you got to have a bond.
Correct.
The contractor's bond isn't good for a project where you're cleaning up a meth house.
We were the first, as I understood it, to seek a developer's contractor's license as a 501c6 is what we are. Apparently through that process, we needed to have a bond which was not previously in place. So we actually tried to seek other avenues like this addresses by, putting our money cash up front, put it in the bank for you, bring in a check, a pile of cash, whatever it is you want, and we're unable to do that. So we were not a contractor before this event, and because of the way we went through it, we had to create this, both the entity and get a bond. And I'm not sure if I've answered your question, but I'm trying to.
It sounds to me, I think I know what Senator Starr's meaning. It sounds to me that the nonprofit became the general contractor.
Correct.
It's what happened, and that there was not a provision then. As opposed to hiring someone, they were the contractor and would then have to meet those obligations that other regular contractors would. But this bill is specific only to illegal drug manufacturing sites, so it wouldn't allow you to do others types of stuff.
And in slight further explanation, I think that exactly summarizes it. The process actually does involve a licensed, certified contractor to do or to supervise the actual cleanup of the meth contaminants. But that's not a total rehabilitation of the property. And essentially what they did was they had the nonprofit purchase the property or acquire the property and became their own general contractor. So that's the explanation.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. We have is it Dan Lidstrom?
Chair Metzger and committee, I'm not cold water, but I'm just...
Go ahead and give your name for the record.
Dan Lidstrom, originally from Prineville.
Okay.
Just my 2 cents worth is, these are contaminated sites. Sometimes nonprofits, or commonly they use volunteer people, and the volunteers sign a waiver of no liability. So I'm just saying, do we still have a problem? According to Mr. Bovet, we do. We've shut down the local labs, but methamphetamine is still a problem. So I'm just saying, if it works, if no one gets hurt, that's great. But if these are contaminated sites, there's a reason why. There's one in Lincoln County, a block and a half from the city hall, that's been sitting there for 4 years with signs on the doors. So I don't know. I would just say, better to be cautious. Safe than sorry. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Lindstrom. Any other questions? Okay. Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2309 and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2309 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection? Sorry. Senator Deckard, would you carry this bill?
Sure.
Thank you. Okay. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2751. Janet.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2051 is also a unanimous vote out of the House, sponsored by the Committee on Consumer Protection. It would permit an insurer to issue a liability insurance at a preferred rate or premium to construction contractors without violating the current prohibition against fictitious groupings. The insurance division is here to explain what that means. And, Mr. Chair, this is the first of the several bills that we will be receiving that came through the construction claims task force that met during the interim.
Thank you, Janet. Fictitious grouping.
Mm-hmm.
I would seem to say it doesn't exist, right? But Mr. Arnold is going to explain that to us. It's been a while, I think, since you've been before our committee.
Not mine.
Mr. Chair, I've seen Senator Modest Anderson many times, but yes, first time in front of this committee this session, so
yeah.
Glad to be here.
Welcome.
For the record, Joel Ario, I'm the Administrator of the Insurance Division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I was hoping to avoid terms like fictitious groups today to talk in real language instead of insurance speak. But
well, there's a bill that we just moved out of education, general government, requiring plain language, so,
so I will
change this. Yeah.
First describe the bill in plain language and then come back and talk about fictitious groups if you would like. This is, as Janet mentioned, the first bill to come to this committee from the Construction Contractor Task Force. It's one of, I believe, 9 recommendations, 4 of which relate to insurance. And what this bill deals with is a situation where multiple contractors are working on a common job site. The bill in that situation would allow an insurer to write a policy for the entire job site, bringing in all the contractors under one policy. That is today allowed in surplus lines where there is no authorized insurer available, so it can be done, but this bill would allow it to be done by all insurers, authorized insurers coming into that market, so we'd increase the competitive dynamics in that market. And allowing these group policies has a couple real advantages. One is that it reduces friction costs. If you think of a site where you have, you know, a dozen contractors, each of whom is carrying their own liability policy, and then something happens, fingers get pointed in all different directions, and there end up being a lot of friction costs in trying to settle out that issue between multiple insurers and their lawyers and so forth. So this bill would have one liability policy kind of that could respond in those situations. The second reason why it's a good idea is that oftentimes those individual policies that the contractors carry, and they would keep those individual policies as they came into this common job site, will have exclusions in them, and some of the exclusions relate to exactly the most typical use of these group policies. So things like a condominium site, tract housing, multiple family housing. So if you don't have a group policy, you get the worst of both worlds. You have a number of policies, but a lot of them have exclusions that don't respond in that kind of situation. So this is a solution to that kind of problem too. The way in which I misspoke a little bit before, I said this bill would allow the insurers for the first time. The authorized insurers can actually do it today, but they have to overcome this fictitious group law to do it. And what we do is say that in this context, they don't have to meet the administrative burdens to show that this type of grouping is okay. It sounds like I do need to talk about a fictitious group for a minute here, so I'll try to be as brief as I can. The purpose of fictitious group laws is basically to say that in the property and casualty market, insurers or agents can't go around creating groups that are designed to bring somebody in over here and get a good rate and leave out similar people next to them who then bear the brunt of higher rates because of that grouping. This is something that was common in the 30s and 40s and 50s. It could have been around race. It could have been around any issue where, you know, say in a homeowner situation, a number of people get together and bond together and get one homeowner rate, and those guys get a lower rate than they probably should, and everybody else pays the brunt. So there are laws saying that you can't, if you're a legitimate group, like an association or something, you can get a group policy. But in general, if you don't have good indicia of being a legitimate group, we'd call you a fictitious group, and you couldn't do it unless you could show that the group had a real rationale and that there were real market savings to be had by the grouping, and then you'd have to give us data at the end to show that there was actually savings. All of those procedural requirements are what this bill exempts the contractor situation from.
Well, thank you, Stario. Just help me a little bit so I can learn more about this. You gave the example of a type of projects which would have multiple dimensions in which, like South Waterfront or something, you would have all kinds of various contractors involved. Who generally seeks the group liability policy? Is it the general contractor or the project owner? I mean, who is the one that generally looks to provide this kind of umbrella coverage?
Mr. Chair, I'm a little bit out of my environment there in terms of the business deal here. I think it would be the project owner, but I'm not sure. It may be the general contractor, too. I could get somebody to give you answers to that sort of question. I should note when you bring up the South Waterfront project and those kind of projects, there's a much bigger type of project above $90 million where you bring in workers' comp into these deals, too. Those are called WRAPs. And they have a whole separate set of regulations that apply to them, and those are approved individually by us under a specific piece of legislation. This is for smaller projects where the workers' comp is still a separate deal, so it's only the group liability project. Right. I don't know, Mark, do you know the answer to the who seeks those? Pardon?
I think the general gets it.
Okay, so Mark's always smarter than me. So
that was for the people on TV land. That was Mark Long in the back of the room saying he thinks it's the general. Yeah. Any questions? All right, so we're trying to remove barriers.
That's right. Streamline.
Okay. If there's no other questions and no one else has signed up, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2751 and open a work session. Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2751 to the floor for pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection? Ordered. Senator Modest Anderson, would you carry this one?
Sure. Love insurance.
Okay. We're moving right along. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2314. Janet.
Mr. Chair, last but not least, House Bill 2314, at the request of the Judiciary Committee for the Oregon Collectors Association, permits a public body or a person using a private collection agency to add a fee that in part or in whole compensates the public body for fees charged by the private collection agency. There's an emergency clause on the bill. It has no fiscal or revenue impact, and it did pick up a couple of no votes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay. You know, you don't have a red badge unless you get some no votes. So, Mr. Markey. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Markey, representing the Oregon Collectors Association, testifying in support of House Bill 2314. What the bill does is it simply clarifies a law that was enacted back in 2003. In 2003, this legislature enacted a bill that allowed public bodies to add a collection fee to a liquidated and delinquent account when it was turned over to a private collection agency. The law at that time was very specific that the fee could be in, could never exceed what the private collection agency charged. But many attorneys across the state have interpreted the rest of the statute in different ways. Particularly, there's been some local government attorneys that read, if you look at line 9 on the bill, the current statute says for the collection agency fee incurred or to be incurred, and they have interpreted that to mean that if they add a fee, it has to be exactly the same as whatever the collection agency charges. So if the collection agency commission rate is 15%, they read that to say that the fee being added, if they choose to add such a fee, has to be exactly 15%. What this bill does is it simply would allow a public body to add a fee lesser than that of what a collection agency charges. So in the example I gave of 15%, if the local government or a state agency or whoever wanted to add a fee of only 5%, this bill would allow them to do so. That was our intent when the legislation passed in 2003. No, it's never been tested in the court, but definitely many attorneys are interpreting it differently across the state. So, again, it's just a clarification to allow a public body to add, when they add this fee that's already allowed, so that they can add a lesser fee. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Senator Starr.
Thank you. Does it allow you, the public body, to charge a fee higher than the, 20% in your example?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, no, there's explicit language. If you look at lines 15 and 16, except as provided by federal law, the public body may not add a fee under this section that exceeds the collection agency fee, the collection fee by the private collection agency. So that there is a definite limit as to what the public body could add. And again, this is just letting them add something lesser, because most public bodies, if they choose to use this tool, and most of the time it's not even used, it's more of a tool used as they're trying to collect a debt, saying, you know, if you don't pay today, then, and it eventually goes to a collection agency, we could possibly add this fee. So it's an enticement to get somebody to pay their bills quicker. But it could never be more than whatever that commission rate is.
In Section 2 of the bill, a person, is that, so this basically this would apply to anybody, any business person, because this is commercial debt.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, yeah, and I should have pointed that out, I'm sorry. When the law passed originally, it was, there were two parts. There was one for public bodies, and there was one for commercial accounts. And this would not be a consumer debt, but this would be a business-to-business transaction. And the idea there was that when two businesses, two commercial entities are entering into a contract between themselves, if one wanted to charge the other collection fees, they could do so. Again, those fees are limited to whatever the collection agency charges, and the person there would be the company trying to collect the debt. Again, they would just be able to add a lesser amount.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. I think, you know, people seem to be all comfortable with that. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2314 and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2314 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2314 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And
I have a request.
Yes.
Of Mr. Marquis, if it's possible to get some information in writing, that would be terrific. Thank you.
Did you hear that? Okay. Thank you. Okay, I guess I'll carry that one, and we're adjourned.